Hi, this is Angela Knoppenberger. I am talking to Dr. Donald Brief. I am in the Rauner Special Collections Library at Dartmouth College, and he is talking to me from his home in Maplewood, New Jersey. The time is 1:21 p.m. on August 18th, 2015. So, Dr. Brief, let's start from the very beginning. Can you tell me where you were born and the date?
I was born in Newark, New Jersey, February 22nd,
1933. 33? What were your parents' names?
My parents' name was Pauline and Philip Brief.
Okay. And can you tell me a little bit about your childhood? Was your town suburban, rural?
Well, I was the oldest child in the family. I have a brother 2 years younger, and we lived in Newark, New Jersey until I was about 10 years old, and then we moved to South Orange, New Jersey, where I continued with my school and went to high school, Columbia High School, in the South Orange Maplewood school system, and then went on to Dartmouth College and Dartmouth Medical School, and ultimately Harvard Medical School after that, graduating in 1957.
Right, awesome. Do you mind if we talk just a little bit about, I mean, your childhood, just kind of growing up, in the time that you were growing up, you would have been alive for World War II. Did any of this, you know, shape your childhood in any way?
Well, I think I probably had a very normal childhood without a lot of unusual excitement. I was interested when I was a youngster. And in addition to just going to school, I was interested in sports. So once I finished school, I'd want to go out and play whatever sport was in season.
Oh, so then, did you play kind of?
And then when I went to high school, I actually became a varsity swimmer. I was on the swimming team, and that occupied a lot. And I became interested. My dad was a golfer, so he got me interested in golf as well when I was a youngster, and I started playing a little bit when I was 11 or 12. And then, of course, that became... Go ahead.
I'm so sorry. The audio is cutting a bit back and forth. Did you swim throughout high school and college?
I didn't swim at Dartmouth. I swam in high school. It was pretty good, actually. I was on a very good swimming team. We won the state championship in my junior year, and they came in second in my senior year, and I was second in the 100-yard freestyle in the state. In my senior year, anchored their winning medley relay team, so I got a silver and gold medal at that time. And then I went to college. I thought I was going to swim, but I was actually having a lot of trouble with my eyes with the chlorine in the pool. And I frankly was afraid that I wouldn't be able to study. When I was in high school, I came home and didn't do any studying. I did it all in school. After swimming practice, I used to put a cloth over my eyes and go to bed, you know.
Studies are important.
The next day from the chlorine. And I was really quite afraid to do it. So I played freshman golf at Dartmouth. I made freshman team, but that was about it. After that, I concentrated on my pre-med stuff.
Yeah. Did you always know that you would be, you know, going on the medical track to be a doctor? When did that sort of, that career decision happen for you?
I didn't. When I was growing up, my dad was a CPA and had his own accounting firm that specialized in the savings loan industry, and I always thought I'd go into that. And as a matter of fact, when I went to Dartmouth, when I got accepted to Dartmouth, I assumed I would go to Tuck School, and I didn't even know that Dartmouth had a 2-year medical school. But what happened that first, the summer between high school and medical school and college, I worked as a camp counselor in the Berkshires, and some of the counselors were first-year medical students who obviously I hung out with and got to know. Mm-hmm. And one of the counselors, I was in his bunk. I was too young to have my own kids to take care of, so I was like an assistant to him. And spending time and talking about it, I became somewhat interested. And so when I arrived to matriculate at Dartmouth, I found out there were two lines. One line was for the regular BA degree, and the other line was for pre-med in the Dartmouth Medical School. So I asked somebody, what was that all about? And they told me it's a 3-year deal, and you get into medical school if you can make it. There's only 24 guys that get accepted. But if you get in at the end of 3 years, you save a year of college and so on and so forth. So since the first year didn't mean anything, it was all the same freshman curriculum, I thought, well, I might as well get in this line. It sounded interesting. You know, when I spent time with these guys in the summer, it sounded more interesting than being an accountant. I had no doctorate.
That sounds...
So anyway, I signed up for that program, so that's what happened.
Yeah, that sounds very competitive. And you mentioned earlier that you were worried about not being able to study. Was your time at Dartmouth very academically rigorous? Were you very much focused on studies, or do you have other sports? You mentioned sports, but any other clubs that you were involved in?
I did my work on a regular basis. I wouldn't be what you call a grind. I never believe you learn much after 11 o'clock at night, so I used to go to bed at 11 o'clock pretty much. And I did my work. I went to classes. I didn't cut and took notes. And I was only a pretty average student in the beginning. I was surprised how much you had to study for finals. I didn't realize finals were so important. So my first semester was a rude awakening to me. And I wasn't that brilliant an undergraduate student. I think I got, in those days, there was no grade inflation. But I remember going into finals my first semester freshman year with what I thought were all A's. And I came out with 4 B's and a C, a respectable 2.8 average. So that didn't sound too hot to me. So I knuckled down and did a little better after that.
So but that really inspired.
Yeah, I had fun. I had participated in, all the intramural sports for the fraternity and the dormitory in my freshman year, and played golf and skied, and I think I enjoyed myself. I didn't study all the time by any means.
What fraternity were you affiliated with?
Pi Lambda Phi.
Oh, okay. Were you very active with the fraternity?
Not at all. Except for playing in the intramural sports and going to an occasional party. I didn't live there, and I got into medical school at the end of my junior year, so we weren't in the fraternity in our sophomore year. So I really only had 2 years in the fraternity itself, and I really wasn't that active other than just having a little fun there once in a while.
And this is when Dartmouth was still all male. Could you state the years that you attended Dartmouth?
Yeah, 1950 to 55, which was the medical school. I was class of 54.
Right. So how the program worked is that you were accepted in your junior year, and then you spent
2 years at Dartmouth. My first year of medical school was really my senior year, and I actually took the Great Issues course to complete the BA requirements. And we graduated with our class with my BA degree and Chemzo major. But I actually completed my first year of medical school. And then we went a second year to the medical school and left to go transfer to the third year of whatever medical school you wanted to finish up at. We pretty much had our choice in those days. The Dartmouth students were accepted virtually anywhere they wanted to go in those days. Yeah, we were good students, and most medical schools lost students by the second year, so they have openings, and we're glad to enlarge their classes and, I think, fill out their classes with Dartmouth students. I think it does.
A great program. I was just saying, that sounds like a great program, and really, kind of paved the way for you to get into a great medical school.
Yeah, it was. It's a very unusual program. It doesn't exist anymore. And I don't think there, now that I know about, there are not too many 2-year schools anymore anywhere. There are several 5-year, 7-year programs now throughout the country, which do the same thing, but you stay on at the same university and you do it in 7 years.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never heard of your particular program at Dartmouth, and I guess that's because it doesn't exist anymore. Going back to your time as an undergraduate, talking about how Dartmouth was all male, how did that impact social life? I mean, even class dynamics, or was it something that you never really affected you or the class or the campus culture, do you think?
Well, you know, it's just what we expected. I knew what it was, and we used to occasionally go down to Smith and date one thing and another, you know, road trips. And my sophomore year, I met my wife-to-be, and so I had a steady, you know, girlfriend pretty much the rest of the way until I got married.
Where did you meet her?
In the community in South Orange, New Jersey. She was a local girl,
okay.
So younger, and I met her at a party and one thing and another.
Oh, okay. So I didn't know if she was from the Dartmouth area. So...
No, she wasn't from the Dartmouth area. She was from New Jersey.
Back home. So after undergrad, were you still living in dorms and kind of considered part of the Dartmouth campus? Even when you were in your second year of med school,
Once I got into medical school, I always lived in the dormitory. I had the same roommate for 3 years. And once we got into, I got into medical school, I moved off campus to West Wheelock Street.
Oh, okay.
To an apartment with several of the other medical students. There were, I think, two upperclassmen upstairs and five first-year medical students lived on the first floor. We rented, and we studied together and lived together there. And then I became part of the medical school fraternity, Alpha Kappa Kappa, which was the medical school fraternity. So I belonged to that as well, and I didn't have much to do with undergraduate life thereafter. I never really went back to the Pi Lam house, and we hung out, the medical students pretty much hung out together.
When you were in medical school, were you still living by that, you know, in bed by 11 o'clock sort of study method, or did things get a little harder?
No. I went to bed at 11. The dean always emphasized that, to get a good night's sleep and do your work and be efficient. And I very rarely stayed up all night to study, once in a blue moon for an exam or something, but... most of the routine times and go to bed at normal. We got up early, you know, we had to get up around 6 o'clock in the morning, so I always try to get a good night's sleep.
Do you remember any big events, whether political? Dartmouth has a bit of a history of things like protesting, especially during Vietnam, although that was after you graduated. Do you remember any sort of events like that happening during your time at Dartmouth?
I think undergraduates were not activists in those days.
Oh, really?
No, we accepted everything, and I can't remember any public outbursts or any activity on the part of the men in the campus in those days. The 50s was after the war, and I think everything was pretty settled. It was the years of Eisenhower, and I think the country was not in a
tumultuous.
In an activist mood, at least as I remember it. I don't recall any particular excitement about were political issues or social issues in those days.
So then, I mean, just going by the years that you were attending college, there really was no talk of Vietnam, which is
not at all.
Speaking about later.
Sure, that was way, way before Korea was finishing up. The Korean
Anything
War.
Anything about the... Yeah, anything about the Korean War ever reach campus? Any talk?
No, not many. Again, none of the undergraduates that were veterans, and there was no talk of much of the war. Nobody there was involved in Korea, and I really don't think we thought very much of it. I don't remember the exact dates and when that conflict ended, but it wasn't.
It didn't impact Dartmouth.
Not at all. Not to my way of thinking, no. No, as I said, I don't think we were very, the students in those days, and I can speak for myself, I don't think, you know, we thought much about those things. I think we were happy. We were privileged students to be at Dartmouth, I think, and enjoyed everybody enjoyed their time there and got involved in the social and academic life, and that was about it.
That's fair enough. Can you tell me a little bit about your time at Harvard? You would have had to, of course, move to Boston.
Yeah. I got married when I finished Dartmouth Medical School. We married. So I went down to Harvard as a married student, and we got an apartment.
Did your wife come with?
And the 2 years in medical school, they were wonderful. I mean, I personally enjoyed medical school. The 2 years at Dartmouth and 2 years at Harvard more, and the academics much more than my undergraduate experience. I had fantastic teachers and role models, and my classmates were exceptional people down there. You know, one of the things when you go to school, like a school like Dartmouth and Harvard, the people around you have a greater influence on you almost than your teachers. Surrounded by, you know, really brilliant people who are motivated and, you know, are interesting, and they're all good models, you know, for us. Yeah. So when we came down to Harvard, there were 12 of us, and we kind of stuck together because we didn't know our fellow classmates. They had been together for 2 years, so it was a little cliquey socially. But gradually we got absorbed into the class and made friends, and the medical school experience and living in Boston and being newly married, it was a very exciting time for us.
Yeah, that does sound very, very exciting. You had children during this time, yes?
Yeah, well, my wife became pregnant, I'm trying to think, probably about 6 or 7 months after we were married, and we had our first baby in 1956.
While you were at Harvard?
And then that was before I graduated, actually. We had our first child. And then my second child was born in 58 during my first year of residency.
Oh, okay. And 4 children. You had 4 children when you were sent to Vietnam? Was that
Yes.
As many children as you ended up having?
Yes.
4?
Yeah.
Yeah, so
by the time I got drafted, I was 34. That was 1967 already. I graduated medical school in 57, so it was 10 years later that
I got drafted.
And my oldest child was 12, and my youngest was about 2 or 3.
Okay, sorry, I didn't mean to jump ahead, actually. Let's finish up at Harvard. Had you already decided that you would go into being a surgeon?
Yeah, I pretty well decided in my third year. It was while I was down at Harvard that I was influenced more by the surgeons and my teachers, and I actually took an elective course in dog surgery. They offered it in those days. They wouldn't do it now, but they offered a class for 28 people to a 6-week course, and we did some surgery on the animals, and they were survival cases where we did sterile technique and anesthesia and took care of the animal. And the animal lasted through the entire program if you did the right operations and so on. So I had a chance to do surgery, and that convinced me that that's what I wanted to do. So I would say I made a definite decision around the middle of my third year of medical school to become a surgeon.
And where did you do your residency?
In Boston at the Peter Ben Brigham Hospital.
Is that where you ended up? Okay, but that's not where you ended up practicing, right?
No. But we lived in Boston. I did my training and stayed there for 7 years. It was a rigorous training program and very competitive to get into it. They took 6 interns. There were about 250 applicants. And we had to take an exam and one thing and another, and oral exams. And then they competed, and one thing led to another. Anyway, I was lucky enough to get that program. So.
And that's what led to you staying in Boston for those 7 years?
I stayed in Boston for my whole training period, and then I began to look around for things to do. And based on a lot of reasons, we came back to New Jersey, where both our families were from and where I had many friends, and I had a wonderful career opportunity in practice to join a group of 2 surgeons, a father and son team, who I had met, who offered me a nice position and with what I thought was a great opportunity. I was interested in clinical work primarily at the time, and to stay in Boston, I would have had to do laboratory research along with a very small amount of clinical surgery. That's what they emphasized. at the Brigham, and I thought my opportunities to do what I wanted to do were better. I was better suited to private practice rather than a totally academic career. Turned out a little differently, actually, once I came down.
What happened once you came down?
Well, I didn't realize it completely when I took the opportunity. When I went into practice, I was at a teaching hospital with residents, and when I came back from Vietnam in 1969, we became affiliated with a medical school, and I became a teacher and a clinical professor anyway, in spite of myself. So I spent the rest of almost all my career teaching, as well as doing my private practice, and I was a clinical professor at the medical school and in charge of academic training of residents and students and so on. So I got involved in academia, but I wasn't involved in laboratory research. It was basically clinically oriented, which suited me better.
Yeah, so you still did get to pursue what you were most passionate about. So what year did you move back to New Jersey, just for record?
1964.
So by this time, are you hearing about Vietnam? Is that, you know, start of the is it part of the national conversation? Is it something you're even worried about?
It still wasn't really much in my radar screen, you know. I was already married with kids and in practice, and Vietnam was still, there was no war going on. There was some involvement with some of the American expeditionaries. We know Kennedy sent some people in as advisories, but there really wasn't a full-fledged war going on until probably around 66, when became more aware of what was happening, and I realized there was a chance if I didn't turn 35 that I might get, you know, I might get drafted before 35. I knew that might happen. So
the concern of being drafted was something that you had before actually.
Well, yeah, about a
drafted.
Year or two before when things began to get active in 67, 60, late 66, 67. I knew that it might happen.
Did you know anybody who had been drafted?
I began meeting some doctors who had been drafted or heard about them, and I knew it was happening. And but I continued with my practice. I was very involved in starting up and working with the group, so I was busily engaged, so to speak. And
did you think that being a doctor, having your skill set, made you more valuable?
They didn't think about it. That had nothing to do with who got drafted and who didn't, at least. Mm-hmm. It had to do with your assignments once you were drafted, how you could be put to use by the military. But before you're drafted, you were just on a list, you know.
Okay. So let's talk about what you
actually. It had nothing to do with what your specialty was. I could have been a dermatologist. It wouldn't have made any difference.
Okay. So let's talk about when you actually were drafted. Do you remember the day that you received
exactly.
the letter?
Yeah, well,
Could
what
you
happened?
Walk me through it, please.
What happened was that I so happens that particular day my wife's parents were going on a vacation, so I took them down to Newark Airport to drop them off, and then I went back to my hospital, which is not far from the airport, and to make rounds and take care of my patients. I was on call. And about 10 or 11 o'clock that morning, I got a page, and it was my wife saying, "Sit down, I have something awful to tell you." So I figured the plane had crashed because I'd just taken her parents to the airport. And I sat down, and she said, "Guess what? You've been drafted." She opened the letter that came from the government. So I said, "Thank God," because I thought her parents were killed. So kind of, it didn't surprise me that I got drafted. It really didn't. I figured it was coming, and the way things were going. In 67, things were getting worse, and they were needing more surgeons and calling up people left and right. So it didn't surprise me.
So were you at the hospital and she called you, or did you go home to...
I was at the hospital and she called me. The mail came, and she saw the letter from the government. She knew what it might be because we talked about it. So she opened it and read it to me, so...
So you talked about it before. Had you Was it simply like hypothetical talk, or had you seriously considered?
No, hypothetical. We hoped I wouldn't get drafted. We were just crossing our fingers and hoping to get through it. But
You were drafted, what were the actions that you took to prepare your family for you being gone?
What I did right away, I figured, well, maybe I can get myself some kind of assignment that, you know, wouldn't separate me from my family and maybe bring some of my academic talents into use. And so I made an appointment down in Washington with the major who was in charge of making assignments for the surgeons. They had specific people involved in placing doctors so they could be of the most use. So I found out who was going to be making my assignment, my basic assignment. So I went down to Washington for the day, and I met with this nice major. He's a nice fellow. And we talked, and I told him what my situation was and that I thought maybe I could be of some use, you know, teaching in an academic center and this, that, and the other. And he said, well, we have, you know, regular Army guys who do that, who join the Army as residents to do it, and let me see what I can do for you. So he came back and said, you know, I have just the thing for you. I said, what's that? He said, you can come to Virginia, to the Army base in Virginia with your family, and you can work in the Pentagon, and you can assign all the medical disability forms for the guys coming home with vascular injuries. Since you had a lot of vascular surgical experience, you'd be expert at that, and you can stay there with your family and be together for the 2 years, and all you have to do is do these assignments of disability. So I said, well, when do I do surgery? When do I do my clinical work? It's a 2-year period. He said, you don't have to do any clinical work. You can just be in the Pentagon for 2 years. So I said, well, what's my alternative? So he said, your alternative, we can give you a year as chief of general surgery at Fort Dix at Wilson Army Hospital, and you'll be chief there for a year. And he was probably spending a year in Vietnam as chief of general surgery at an evacuation hospital. So I said, I'll take that.
I came
home and told my wife, and she wasn't angry with me. She just said, I knew you would do that.
Did you think about how, you know, going to Vietnam was much more dangerous? I mean, the threat of death was much more
that.
Real.
I didn't think about that. I thought that it was a totally selfish decision on my part. But not altogether that, in a sense. I don't want to sound like a patriot, but I didn't want to be useless sitting in a Pentagon for 2 years, not doing any surgery. I thought I'd be miserable. I'd come out of it, I probably wouldn't be able to do surgery anymore if I didn't operate for 2 years. And I thought I'd make my family miserable. And I thought I could be of some value in Vietnam. By this time, I knew it was a stupid war, and kids were getting shot and killed and maimed and everything else, and if I could at least give them good surgical care and get some of them home to their mothers, that was more important than sitting at a desk. And I knew that at least we'd have one good year at Fort Dix altogether. And a year over there, I thought I'd be some good. And I'd always had some curiosity about what it would be like to be a surgeon in a military conflict. When I was training, all the attendings had been in Europe during World War II, and they used to talk about it, and we used to listen, and I always almost envied them of that experience, because it makes you a better surgeon. You come out of something like that pretty fearless. So I was not going to sit at a desk. There was no way I was going to do that.
How did you break the news to your children?
Just told them that's what happened. I was in the Army, and we're going to go to Fort Dix and have an adventure and live there for a year. And then I would go into Vietnam. My oldest girl understood. The other kids, the family was intact. I mean, their mother was there. We had help. We had an au pair from Sweden. Our parents were alive and lived within a couple miles, and so they could give support. The two father grandfathers were young and healthy in those days, relatively young, and could act as surrogates for me. And so I don't think it impacted much on the kids at all.
Okay. Did they ever express any worry knowing that their father was going to war?
I really don't think so. My wife never let them feel that way. And I wasn't going, no, I was not a combat surgeon. You know, doctors don't often get killed in these situations, and I didn't never occurred to me that I was in, going to be in any danger particularly.
So can you tell me about a one-year commitment. Can you tell me about the year at Fort Dix? Where is the fort, and when did you move there?
Well, what happened, we moved. First, when you went in the Army, you spent 6 weeks down in Texas. So I had to go down there for 6 weeks for basic training. Don't forget, we had no military experience. So they give the doctors a basic course in military things, you know, how to dress, how to salute, how to march a platoon, and then also courses in military surgery, some academic courses, and some training with a rifle and a gun and all that kind of stuff.
Were you training with other doctors?
We had to shoot a .45, of an M16. They teach you some basics just in case, I guess. So we learned all that stuff. And then after 6 weeks, then my assignment to Fort Dix came through, of course, my wife visited me when I was down in San Antonio for a week or so, and then we came back. We moved down to Fort Dix. Actually, they had very nice quarters for officers, for housing.
Where's Fort Dix?
A little ranch house, and I rented my house out in Maplewood to a friend who needed some quarters for a while. He was in the middle of a divorce with his kids, and he needed a house for a while, so he took my house in Maplewood, and we went down to Fort Dix. The Army moved us, and it was not difficult. They do a terrific job moving people. An Army move is better than any civilian move. They wrap every glass, and they do everything. And so I went to Fort Dix, and I was chief of general surgery there, and I enjoyed it. It was living on a base. It was a really different experience. Had an officers' club where you could go for dinner, very nice at night. They had a lot of facilities rented for sports and athletics, rifle range you could use all the time, and a skeet shooting range, and the kids had gyms and basketball. The children went to school. Three of my kids went to school there, the elementary school near the base, and they had a golf course on the base, and I had a nice experience there, actually. And we were busy. Yes. We had plenty of work. The base had 50,000 men. We must have done two or three appendix operations every night, almost, plus other things. It was also a VA hospital for the retired military in the area, so we were quite busy with it. We had a clinic, and it was active. And we took care of a few veterans coming home from Vietnam, but not too many actually came to our place.
What state is Fort Dix in?
Fort Dix is New Jersey.
New Jersey still? Okay.
70 miles from where we originally lived. So, again, it wasn't too difficult for us. I remember at that point there began to be a lot of resentment about the war, and I can remember just an incident. We got to Fort Dix in October, late October, and at the end of November, my hospital that I've been working at had the annual doctor's dinner dance. And I was down at Fort Dix, and so I said, well, let's go to the dinner dance. I was off. And I decided I didn't have a tuxedo. It was a formal. I wore my dress blue, as every surgeon, every officer had to have a dress blue uniform, which is formal. So I wore my dress blue uniform up to the party at a catering hall up here in New Jersey. And much to my disappointment, I was actually almost verbally abused by several of the doctors and wives at that function because they thought I was, you know, pro-war wearing the uniform, and everybody there was very much against Vietnam, of course. And because I was, you know, wearing the uniform proudly, I took a little bit of a beating, a little different than it is today.
How did that make you feel? I mean, were you...
Well, I didn't feel good about it at all. I was kind of angry. I mean, the fact that
I was angry that
the guys were abusing me, verbally abusing me.
Were you ever upset that you were forced to be involved with this war that you didn't necessarily support?
No, I'll tell you the truth. I told you I didn't. It was a bad war. But the boys who were fighting it weren't bad. They were forced to be there. And that's all the more reason that they get good care.
That is a great point.
And I just felt that I had the ability and the skills to help them. And if they were fighting something that it was particularly difficult and bad, and I could do something to help them, I didn't feel bad about being there, no. And it was an adventure. I mean, it was a very exciting thing to be part of all that.
Yeah.
I wasn't happy with our mission, but I was happy to be able to help the boys.
Were you ever, when you were back in San Antonio for your training, were you with other doctors or were you with younger
doctors.
Men who had been drafted? What was the age range? What, I mean, of course, to be a doctor, you're already mid-20s, but were
you
like the older?
The range went up to 30. Nobody was older than 34, 34 and a half. And some, of course, were younger just out of internships, who would have made them 28, 27, some of the people that came in. But a lot of them were like myself, people who got pulled in just before they turned 35. In my group, they were between 30 and 35, most of them.
Wow. Was there any sort of camaraderie around that, kind of being drafted in right at the last minute?
Yeah, we made some friends, but I tell you the truth, I didn't maintain friendships with any of the people that I was at Fort Sam Houston, because we were only there 6 weeks, and we were from all different parts, and they were all different disciplines, and then everybody went every which way after that. So
did you ever see any of them in Vietnam?
No, not I mean, Vietnam is different. I'm talking about Fort Sam.
Did you see any of the people
you trained
with?
Army Hospital, and the people I was with there weren't necessarily the people I went over to Vietnam with. It turned out that I wasn't at Fort Dix for a year because things got bad in Vietnam, and we were only in Fort Dix from November till I actually had to leave May 1st. So I only wound up being there about 6 months when I got sent to Vietnam, because by that time it was 1968, and Tet had come, and it was a very bad time, and they needed more surgeons. So my time at Fort Dix was cut short, and I moved my family back to Maplewood, and I went over to Vietnam. And that May 1st
so,
of 6.
Can you tell me about, moving to Vietnam? You flew, I'm assuming. Do you remember anything about that flight?
It's like... Did you ever see the movie Dr. Zhivago or read the book?
Yes.
Well, do you know how the doctor was caught up in the forces of history? He was conscripted by the communists to be their doctor. He was taken from his family. His whole life was dislocated. You sort of remember that feeling about it? Maybe you don't. But anyway.
I remember, yeah.
But when I went over to Vietnam, my father-in-law drove me to Newark Airport, and I got on the plane, went to San Francisco, where I was bused up to Travis Air Force Base, and a few hours later got on a plane with 200 and some odd other guys, not all doctors, mostly enlisted men, and it was United Flight Charter, and we flew to Hawaii, to Guam, to Midway. We made stops because the plane needed to refuel. It was so full. And ultimately Okinawa, and then into Vietnam landing at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So within a 24-hour period, I went from being my family with a goodbye party to being in the middle of this war. And it was kind of a dislocating experience, to tell you the truth. And when I got off the plane at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, it was exceedingly hot. About 95 degrees, like today here, 95 degrees, 95 humidity, and that's the way it was pretty much all the time in the South. And there was a smell of burning rubber, burnt out latrines, and burning rubber tires, and I said to myself, I don't know how the hell I'm going to last a year here in this godforsaken environment. And then I went from there to the replacement company where you stayed a day or two till you got your assignment in Vietnam, and the first night in the replacement company, after dinner, they had a movie, and I figured I'll walk into the movie, and it was The Sound of Music. And I walked in the part where the kids jumped in the bed with Julie Andrews,
Maria,
because
yeah.
Thunderstorm, you know, and she sang that song to them, and the kids were jumping around in the bed, you know, having been bathed and cleaned, and I swear I could smell my children, you know. And at that point, I cried. I can still remember how I felt. All of a sudden, I missed everybody terribly. I thought, what a stupid thing this is to be here in this mess, you know. And then I got my assignment and went to my hospital, and met my people and everything. And then it became a terrific experience. I made some very good friends, we're still friends with, and of course, worked hard during that year and spent a year there. And At the end of 4 months, I got a leave to go up to... Actually, I took some casualties up to Tokyo. They had to be accompanied. And I met my wife in Tokyo for a week. She came over.
Oh, that's lovely.
I had the money at that point, having been in practice 3 years, to bring her to Tokyo. So she came over, and we had a nice week together. And that was at 4 months. And then after 8 months, I had R&R and met my family in Hawaii with the kids and everything. I was only apart from her 4 months at a time, 4 months, 8 months, and then I came home at 12 months. So it wasn't terrible, really. We got along okay with it. Our marriage held up. It wasn't a good place to be if you had a rocky marriage. I think the year separation and everything else was wrecked a lot of marriages, but ours was a good one, and we were fine with it.
That's so nice to hear, and I'm glad that you had those great breaks to catch up with your family. Can you just state for the record what hospital and location you were stationed at during your time at Vietnam?
Yeah, I was at the 24th Evacuation Hospital in a place called Long Binh, Longbinh, which was near the town of Benoit, and about 18 miles north of Saigon on Route 1. Out of Saigon, that's where I was stationed. It was a big base. It was the biggest base in Vietnam. At the time I was there, it was approximately 50,000 men. It was like a city. It was a 7 mile. It was a rubber plantation that had been appropriated and paying rent to a family, and they built the base on it. And it was like a city. It was a 7 mile triangles. Each leg of the equilateral triangle was 7 miles, and somewhat fortified with barbed wire and stuff. And within it was a city. There were roads, Chinese restaurants, barbershop,
wow.
Living quarters, office buildings, all made of wood. Quickly, most of the buildings were Quonset huts, you know, large Quonset huts. And the hospital was put together. And on one leg of the triangle. We actually, the base was big enough, we had two evacuation hospitals at two different points of the equilateral triangle. The 24th Evac was one, and that was where I was. And it was like being in a city where you have a hospital in down in lower Manhattan, then you have another one up by Columbia, you know, in upper Manhattan. We were that far apart, and so we didn't have much to do with one another. The casualties came in different directions. And
You mentioned in your the information that you provided DVP that you were seeing, you know, American soldiers, American civilians, Vietnamese civilians, or Vietnamese people as well. What was this like to have people from both sides coming into your hospital?
Well, we had the prison hospital was right next to ours. When prisoners were wounded, we took care of them as well. And we didn't take care of that many civilians, but we did take care of some civilian casualties, and we also did some elective surgery on civilians when things were quiet, which they are frequently during the war, where you have these periods of boredom where nothing seems to be happening. And we used to go out to some of the local villages and set up clinics and meet the people and win the hearts and minds, so-called, and get some information.
Mm-hmm.
Intelligence people would, and we would meanwhile examine some of the patients and see. And once in a while, we'd find somebody with some pathology, like a big thyroid gland or a palpable gallbladder or a hernia. And when things were quiet, we would bring them back, let them come in, and we would operate on them. But most of all, 99% of our work was, of course, on our own soldiers. But we did take care of those persons. We operated on, there were Australians fighting in the war. There were Filipino regiments. There were Republic of Korean regiments. There were Thai soldiers in Vietnam. They're called the CETA, the Southeastern, I guess it was the Southeastern Associated Treaty Organization. But there were representatives from all those different countries fighting in Vietnam. We don't appreciate that over here because we did the bulk of it, but there were units from those different places.
During those quiet times, what would you do when you weren't in surgery recreation-wise?
Well, you know, when you're at your base, there's not a lot to do. We didn't go gallivanting around the country looking for trouble. So for the most part, we stayed put. We rested between times. We had a schedule where one day we were on 24-hour call. The next day after that, we were off call, except to take care of our own patients. And then the third day, we were on call, so to speak. And then if things got busy, everybody worked. But on a day-to-day basis, usually we had three men on call, three men on second call, and then three men off, three surgeons. And then we would rotate it. But like I said, there were six or seven or eight times when we were all working for 24, 36 hours at a stretch, and then it would be quiet. We'd go back to our routine. But when we were off call, we would write letters and read books and relax, play bridge. There was a swimming pool on the base. We would go to one of the villages. We'd go out on a mission to one of the villages on the days we were off call. The guys were on call, stayed home. But we would go out with a group of MP soldiers and nurses those were our days off. Sometimes we'd go by the river boats, sometimes by road. And on a rare occasion during the day, we'd get out of Saigon and visit down there some friends at the third field and go to a restaurant or something like that. But we never stayed out at night. The roads were not safe at night. If we went down, we'd come back by 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Did you ever feel unsafe besides being out at night, just being in Vietnam in Long Binh? Did you ever feel like the threat of war was coming towards you or that there would ever be any danger of seeing combat?
A couple times. It didn't happen very often, but there were a few times when there were some incoming rockets, things like that, you know. And once when I was evacuating some casualties, the night I was to meet my wife, I had three casualties to take down to the Tonsonet Air Force Base to accompany up to Japan. There were burns. We couldn't take care of bad burns. And they needed a doctor with them to take care of their IV fluids and so on because of the need for fluid in the airplane. They get dehydrated. The humidity is only 25% in an airplane, 30% in those military planes, so they can lose a lot of fluids. So you had to run IVs and be sure everything was all right with them. And the day I evacuated these three casualties, the helicopter came to pick us up around 4 in the morning. And I got on the helicopter with them, and the helicopter took up straight up like an elevator, going up and up and up. So I asked the pilot, why was he doing that? They usually take off sort of like an airplane. You've probably seen them. You know, they kind of swoop up. He said, no, I want to get to 3,500 feet before we leave the confines of the base, because the small arms fire, that's all they had. Small arms fire from the AK-47s only goes to about 3,000 feet. So I said, oh, that's good. So we got up to 3,500 feet and started flying down to Tonsonet. It only took about 10 minutes. And I see these lights coming up at us. I said, are those what I think they are? He said, yeah, they're tracer, they're bullets. They're shooting at us. But the bullets would come up and fall away because we were 3,500 feet. But we did get shot a little bit. It was a little scary at that point, but he knew what he was doing. So I had a lot of confidence in the career military people around me. For the most part, they were very sensible people, and then knew the ropes.
Then
the day before I was to come home, my last day, last night in Vietnam, I had a party for me, my friends, one thing and another, and then I went down to take a shower, and I was walking back on the duckboards to my quarters. You know, the men's showers and latrines, the officers' showers and latrines were about 50 yards from where we slept. And so I was walking back with a towel wrapped around me, and all of a sudden I saw a flash of light over my head, so I landed on the duckboard. I got down real fast, who taught to do that. And the shell exploded about 75 yards away. And I waited a few minutes. That was the end of that. So I got up and went back and took another shower and then went back to bed and came home the next day.
Wow. So what were some of the...
That's really the only time. I really felt very secure almost 99% of the time. I really did.
So that is... That's very interesting to hear. Was the base... would you call it Americanized? Were most of the people you were interacting with American?
Yeah, but we had... We did meet Vietnamese people during the course of the year. Some of them spoke English, and so there was some contact with people other than American, but again, almost all my contact was with the military.
Mm-hmm.
Very little outside contact. Certainly, we made friends with... Actually, did you ever, if you're interested, if you read a book, A Bright and Shining Lie,
A Bright and Shining Lie,
by Neil Sheehan. It's a very good book about Vietnam, and in it, he mentions Mr. Mui, whose family we rented the base from. He was a wealthy Vietnamese man who was kind of his village lord, and we used to go to his village, and his wife would cook his dinners before we came back to the base. And so I got to know him pretty well. He was an influential Vietnamese guy, kind of a double agent. He paid the Viet Cong to stay away from his village. And then he gave us information about them, and he played both ends against the middle. But he's written up in the book. And I actually operated on him. He had a bleeding ulcer one night, and we had to stop his bleeding and do an ulcer operation. So
he was let's talk about...
He was one of the, he and his wife were two of the people we got a little closer to, and people in his village.
Let's talk about the surgeries. First of all, what was your official position at the hospital?
I was chief of general surgery.
Okay. And what were the most common procedures that you were seeing, either on a daily basis or just regularly?
Well, in a military situation, what you're seeing are wounded soldiers with either, for the most part, fragment wounds from exploding grenades and things of that sort, claymore mines, fragment shrapnel wounds, and of course bullet wounds, and occasionally mine, you know, explosives devices. So, but for the most part, we saw a combination of fragment wounds and bullet wounds.
Were there a lot?
A lot, too, like punji sticks and occasionally things like that.
Was the hospital well equipped to handle these kind of injuries? I mean, of course,
it was a fantastic hospital. It was fantastic because, unlike some civilian hospitals, we had all the help we needed. We were well staffed with auxiliary help, aides, technicians, cleaning people, nurses,
How were the facilities?
The facilities were good. I mean, it's amazing what you can do with what appears to be a small hospital. We could do everything. We had all the equipment we needed in the operating room, wonderful instruments, anything we needed, we got. They supplied people with suture material, instruments. We had one x-ray machine, so we had an x-ray machine. We had a laboratory where you get pretty much any laboratory data we needed. We had adequate amounts of blood. Every soldier that came into Vietnam, as soon as he got off the plane, donated a unit of blood. So there was lots of fresh blood available if we needed it. And the facilities were quite good. They were makeshift to some degree. And, you know, no private rooms. You had a ward was a big Quonset hut with, you know, cots lined up, close to one another, but the boys could be taken care of. They were comfortable, and we had approximately 12 operating rooms or areas. They were not like rooms; they were stalls. In other words, the Quonset was divided up by room dividers that went halfway up, so we each had a separate sort of private compartment, so you weren't distracted. Everybody operating in the same room. You had your own areas, and it was very adequate. We had all sterile conditions, plenty of gowns, and good anesthesiologists. And I really can't say enough about the medical corps, the Army Medical Corps, in terms of what they provided us with.
That's really great to hear that there was that medical treatment available. Do any either procedures or incidents from your time at Long Bend stick out, whether they affected you, challenged you medically to step
Oh yeah, well
there's
so
the
many.
Challenge?
I really can't go into all of them. I don't know if you want to hear one or two.
Oh, that would be great. That would be great. Please.
I'll tell you two. Two okay. of my more favorite ones, because I have follow-ups on them. But one of the cases was a boy was terribly injured, came in a captain, his group was ambushed, and he came in just a mess. His one leg was almost blown off. He had fragment wounds to the abdomen, neck, fragments in his eye, and he had a skull injury, a head injury. And so we started, the general surgeons, we had to do what was life-saving first, so we stopped the bleeding and opened his abdomen and fixed him up internally, where he had several holes in his bowel. And then we amputated his leg and then fixed the bleeding vessels in his neck, which had been contained by the hematoma first. And then the eye doctors took out one eye and took the fragments out of the other. We wouldn't know if he would see again. And then the neurosurgeons took the bone fragments out of his head and everything else. And he stabilized and did fairly well, and we didn't know quite what he was going to be like, and we evacuated him to Japan after several days when he was stable. And about 6 weeks later, I got a letter from a general thanking me for leading the team that took care of his son. He was a West Point graduate, the captain, and the father was a general, and he wrote me this nice letter and thanking me. And I never heard from the kid again. Now, 25 years later, when I got home, in 1994, we had a reunion of my hospital, the 24th EVAC in Washington, D.C., and we had several hundred people come back, doctors, nurses, and patients. I don't know how they put it all together and got all these people. And everybody got up and gave a talk a little bit and told what they were, how they were involved in the hospital, where they were patients, and what's going on with their lives. And this nice-looking guy comes up with a little bit of a limp. Tells us he's married, he's got four children, he runs an HMO in Virginia. And it turns out he was the guy that I'd operated on.
Wow.
And I went up to him afterwards, of course, and he remembered my name, and we went to the wall, actually, the Vietnamese wall, the memorial wall, as a group, and we're standing there, and it's arranged by dates of death, not alphabetically. So he's looking at February of 1969, when his group came in, and he said, these are my men, these are guys who were with me, were all killed, and it would have been me too if it wasn't for you guys. So he started to cry, I started to cry, my wife started to cry. It was pretty moving, but here he was leading a relatively normal life after that devastating injury, which again shows that when you have these young people, if you give them good care and save them, it's more than worthwhile, I can't tell. It's probably more rewarding in some respects than a lot of the stuff I did during my career. I was operating on, 85-year-old demented people with a surgical problem and having to take care of them and what for, and what's ahead of them compared to these young people. So, and then I had another case, which was, I won't bore you with any more cases, but...
No, please. This is great.
My more interesting case was they brought in a Vietnamese woman pregnant near term with a gunshot wound to her left upper quadrant. The Viet Cong had come into the village, and for some reason, I think because her husband was in the South Vietnamese Army, they knew, and they shot her. And she came in shock. We rushed her to the operating room. I could hear fetal heart sounds, and from the location of the bullet and the x-ray showing where the bullet was high in the abdomen, I knew the fetus was all right. And we opened her up, and I couldn't see anything because the uterus was so big. And there was blood all around the uterus, and I figured the spleen was ruptured. And in order to expose it, I did a cesarean section and delivered this 8.5-pound baby girl. She was almost a full-term baby. Gave her off to the nurses. The uterus contracted, and I could see what was going on. And then I took the spleen out and fixed the holes in her stomach and sewed her up. And the baby, of course, the nurses, we had no equipment for babies there, so the nurses made a little bassinet out of a, you know, a set of drawers with linen in it. And we sent down to Saigon and got sterile water and Similac and the usual things for babies. And we started to take care of the baby. And the mother did fine. She recovered. And about the fifth or sixth day, she's ready to go home. So we were going to give her the baby. And one of the cleaning ladies, Vietnamese cleaning ladies with the Army paid to work, came up to the nurse and said, "Don't send her home with the baby. She doesn't want it. She's not going to take care of it. She may dump it in the river. It's a girl. Bad luck. The whole business." Very, you know, ignorant people, and that was their thoughts about it. So we told her, go home, we'll take care of the baby. So she goes home. She never couldn't care less about the baby.
Wow.
Now we've got this baby girl in our hospital. So we start taking care of her. The nurses take care of her. And she's growing and giving her bottles. She was like a mascot. We kept her in the ICU because we always had nurses there. And a lot of us had kids and whatnot, so we would go down and play with the baby once in a while and give it a bottle and give the nurses a break. And then we got some more equipment. We got a playpen. We got a baby carrier so we could take it outside and take her for a walk. And they named her Barbara. She was a cute little baby. And she was there with us for 6 months. Can you believe that?
That's amazing.
In the middle of this war. And we had a sergeant who ran the operating room, a technical sergeant, career Army guy, by the name of Rodriguez, who had a family at home in Seattle, Washington, and he said, "You know, I'm going to adopt her." And we said, "How are you going to adopt her?" He said, "Never mind. I'm going to adopt her. I know how to do it." He went down to Saigon for a day or two, came back with all the papers, and took Barbara home. And we had this reunion again. I told you about the 25th reunion.
Yeah.
In Washington, all of a sudden, this girl gets up with a baby under her arm. She says, "I'm Barbara Rodriguez, and I was born in your hospital. I'm in a law office now. I just graduated law school, and this is my baby. I'm married. And I think I was," and she said, "I think I'm the only baby that was ever born at the 24th Evac Hospital." And I had delivered her, so afterwards, of course, I went up to her and gave her a hug and a kiss and told her who I was. And so that was a kind of a meaningful reunion as well, and a good long-term follow-up. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, that was one of my better stories. In the middle of the war, I was doing a cesarean section. It's the only one I ever did in practice. I wasn't a gynecologist. But it wasn't a difficult operation, actually, as it went on. But it was interesting.
Wow.
And so a couple of years ago, I got a letter from her father, email from Rodriguez. He had moved to Denver. Where my older daughter lives now, actually, and wanted no more details about the operation. He was writing a little story about it. And I actually have a picture of me holding the baby, a nice picture. I give a lecture to the students, and I usually end the lecture with this particular case because it's pretty dramatic, and the girls all cry and whatnot. So I show them the picture, and he wanted to know all about the details. And worse yet, to put a caption on the end of the story, a month or so ago, I got a note from one of my good friends who said that Barbara had died.
Oh, my goodness. What caused?
We don't know. I don't know. I couldn't find out. I wrote her father a condolence note and Regis a note and so on, but I've never found out what she died of. And she passed away, apparently. Relatively young. I calculated out she had to be... She was born in 68, and so she died this year, so how old would that make her? About 47 or something. I don't know whether she had cancer or what, but she died.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
but
that was one of my more dramatic, non non-military type injuries anyway. Mm-hmm. Military case, no, to a pregnant woman.
Yeah, it's amazing to hear the follow-up, too. I'd love to talk about the reunion later if we can just finish up talking about your time in Vietnam. Please don't worry about boring me, because this is amazing to hear from, you know, as someone who was not around to experience anything like that. But do you have any, you know, cases that really just stuck with you that maybe you didn't get to follow up on?
More dramatic. I'd rather not go into all the other details. There's so many operations, and we participated. I was interested in vascular surgery in those days, and we kept a file on our vascular cases. Dr. Norman Rich, who was the head of surgery at the Armed Forces Medical School in Washington, started a vascular registry, and we contributed over 300 vascular injuries to it, which we kept a record of, and he's written a book about it, vascular injuries and so on, how to manage them. And 300 of those cases are from my hospital, many of which I operated on. Injuries to arteries that had to be repaired and how to do it and so on. Mm-hmm. I actually wrote about four papers that were published in the literature during the time I was there with our experience in management of carotid artery injuries. That was one paper I wrote with a colonel, Mike Acona. I wrote another paper on the management of popliteal artery injuries associated with fractures with a surgeon by the name of Judd McNamara. Wrote another paper on rectal injuries. So I think I published about four papers in the literature out of that experience. We didn't waste our time. We had, we had eight or nine really good surgeons. We had a morbidity and mortality conference every week that I ran. And I got promoted to be a lieutenant colonel, actually. I went in as a major.
Oh.
Got promoted.
Yeah, let's talk about the promotion. Did it come out of a certain event, or was it just your leadership being recognized? What incited
the
promotion?
A combination of age and experience.
Oh.
Once in the Army, you get promoted kind of automatically as you reach certain ages. And for doctors, it has to do with the time out of school and so on and so forth. So I was older when I went in. I was almost 35 when I went in, so I went in as a major. And then when I turned 36 and was there, they gave me the in the field promotion. Not sure why, but combination of things.
Oh, let's talk about promotions. And you wrote that you received the Bronze Star.
Yeah, I did get the Bronze Star. Right.
Was that for a certain instance, or was it again?
I don't know. They when they write their report about it, they quote a batch of stuff, leadership and bravery under it. I guess one time I was operating, and in the middle of the operation, there was this huge explosion, and the doors of the operating room kind of blew open. And I look up, and I'm in the middle of this operation, and everybody's on the floor. My assistant's on the floor, the anesthesiologist. So I said, "Get the F up and get yourself cleaned up. We got to operate on this guy." I heard the explosion. I knew it was the ammunition dump, not us. So that was far away. I wasn't concerned. But everybody else flopped on the floor. So I guess they gave me a medal for that. I don't know.
Well, no, it sounds
The patient. So they all got contaminated. They had to go out and wash up and get new gowns and gloves and stuff. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, I was operating. So.
Well, it's great to hear that you had that commitment, even in the line of fire, as close or far as it was. So you're in Long Bin for a combination of a year?
Yeah, 4-year calendar year. I went home May 1st.
Yeah.
I was 69. Then I had approximately 4 more months left in the Army, and I was sent to Fort Monmouth, Patterson Army Hospital.
And where is that?
Which is near home. It's in Monmouth Beach, New Jersey. And they let me stay close to home. At that time, I didn't have to move anymore. My family was back in our house, and I actually was able to commute on my nights off to my own house. It's only, 40 miles away. And I had officer's quarters for my nights on. I didn't bother to move my family for that four-month period. So I finished up there. That experience there was kind of just putting my time in. It wasn't that busy a hospital.
Mm-hmm. What was it like coming?
Cases and some things to do, but it wasn't. By that time, I was kind of winding down and looking forward to getting out of the Army and getting back to my practice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can you tell me about what it was like coming home? I mean, you mentioned that you'd been to Hawaii, Japan, and you'd seen your family a few times. So this wasn't a complete, you know, haven't seen you in a year type of reunion. But, I mean, you are coming back to the United States. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was a terrific experience. No, I was coming. Listen, I've got to take a bathroom call. Can I just hold on for a minute?
No problem. I will be here.
Yeah, stay on. I won't sign off. I'll be right back.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, we're right there.
Yeah, hi there.
Hi, I am still here. We are.
Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I had to take a break here. My prostate is
coming
out on me.
Oh, my goodness. No worries. You should have let me know. We can take breaks whenever you need. But
okay.
Glad to have you back. We were talking about you coming back to America and what that experience was like returning to the States.
Well, that was wonderful. And like I said, the night before I left, they gave my friends who were with me, you know, most of the time over there, gave me a nice party. And I said goodbye to them, some of whom, of course, I've seen many times since. And came home and flew home and to San Francisco. And I still, one of my favorite songs, I Left My Heart in San Francisco, because that was the closest part of to the United, you know, to Vietnam, of the United States. And we got to the airport there and I had to spend part of the night till I could catch the red eye home and arrived home. And there was like kind of a welcome home little party for me, and it was wonderful. Get home and see my wife.
Yeah. Did your kids at this point, I mean, they're really only a year older. Had it really ever hit them that their dad was in Vietnam? Did you ever sense that?
Well, I think, I don't know how, you know, I can't say how they, you'd have to individually, almost ask each one of them individually what it meant to each of them. They don't talk much about it. I think some of them might say there were times when they had some anxiety. I had three girls and a son. I think my son missed me. When I remember when we came to Hawaii, my family got there first, ahead of me, and they were waiting when the soldiers landed for their R&R. They got in buses, and the buses came to a drop-off point, and there were like four buses full of soldiers coming back for R&R. And for some reason, I had gotten on one of the buses first and went to the back. And so my family was waiting for me, and that bus became the last bus. And my son was about 4 years old, and so he was waiting, you know, for me to get off. And apparently the first bus emptied out, the second bus emptied out, no me, you know. Third bus emptied out, and still no, and then the fourth bus emptied out, and all the soldiers were getting out, and he still hadn't seen me, and he was starting to cry. He thought I wasn't coming or something. And then I came off the bus, and of course everybody was happy. It just happened that way. It wasn't just a chance thing. But anyway, we had a great time together, and I don't think it affected them too bad. Like, there were a couple of traumas with the kids, you know, that we had to handle on the, on the, by mail or by telephone or something once in a while. But nothing too. My son broke his leg during the time I was around, a bicycle accident. But it wasn't too serious, and he healed up nice and quick.
So you're back in the United States. This is 1969.
Yeah, May 1st.
May 1st, 1969. You mentioned earlier how some nasty remarks were made towards you when you were wearing your uniform. Did you ever experience anything like that again on your return, either remarks or hostility towards you because of your involvement with the war?
Oh, no, not really anymore, because don't forget I was out of uniform and I was operating, and people, I mean, most people wouldn't have known I was there, you know.
Yeah.
It wasn't something that we advertised. There were a couple of articles in the paper, you know, during the time people interviewed me that, but, you know, I became a local expert on trauma for a while. So the doctors wanted to hear more about it from a medical point of view, not from a political point of view.
Right.
It was not quite the same. There was certainly no, you know, big welcome or anything like that. It wasn't, except for my family, you know.
Yeah.
But,
so what was it like?
So you sort of took it in stride, and I didn't think too much of it after that.
Yeah, what was it like seeing the war, I mean, I guess the only phrase I can think of is wrap up while being in the States, not in the Army any longer, but still knowing what it had been like over there?
Oh, yeah, well, I had a lot of thoughts about it, and...
I'd love to hear them.
And I thought, you know, I thought, and I wasn't so sure then, I really, you know, now we're getting political. When I was over there, I didn't think everything we were doing was necessarily bad. I thought, you know, the communism was bad, that the people in the North who fled, the Catholics and the landowners, didn't deserve to have to be forced to live under communism. And I thought maybe we were doing some things that were good getting involved. But by the time I came home, I realized it was a civil war. And half of the South Vietnamese didn't want to be under the South Vietnamese rule. That the corrupt, the government, it was kind of like Afghanistan now. I don't think our country's learned very much from Vietnam. It was a civil war, and the government that we were supporting was a corrupt government that didn't really have the support of the people, except for certain groups of people, the wealthy, the landowners, and so on. But the average person didn't like the government. They were corrupt and didn't filter down anything very good to the public. And there was no way we were ever going to win that war because it was a civil war. Just like there's no way we're going to defeat the Taliban. The Taliban are going to be there forever. And the only way they'll ever get defeated is if the Afghanistan people rise up against them, which they're not doing. Their leaders are no...
So,
and the people...
Taking this back to Vietnam, is that what you thought... Is that what you...
Well, I began to realize that that's what was happening. I didn't know it for sure when I was there. But by the time I came home, was around and thought about it for a little while, and read a few books about it, and then realized what I had seen and what was going on. It was a stupid war. And, I mean, when you stop and think about it, and what's worse, I went back to Vietnam last year, in January. We were on a cruise.
Oh, what for?
I went through, yeah, near where I was, Saigon and all over. And here we are. They're a booming economy now. They're a rising country. It's under communist rule, but it's capitalistic. The people are living and enjoying life. It's a young country. Most of the people don't even remember the war. They're all under 50. You don't see very many old people. And what was it all for? I mean, what did we gain out of that whole thing? 65,000 men dead. God knows how many wounded. I mean, Iraq was nothing compared to Vietnam. When we lose 4,000, it's bad enough, but 65,000 boys were killed over there for nothing. We didn't accomplish anything. And the fact is, we didn't have a clear idea what... I mean, if we wanted to defeat them, we could have defeated them. You would have had to go in with a full force of army, go to the north, continue the bombing. They would have capitulated with the bombing eventually. But we didn't have the will to do it, and their people were stronger mentally.
So would you say you were relieved to see America finally say they were going to pull out?
Well, yeah, I was glad that it ended and showed that there were no more lives lost, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It was a tragedy for a lot of the Vietnamese people because a lot of them were hurt by the communist takeover. They had to go to re-education. I mean, it was pretty cruel. The communists were no saints. You know, re-education claim, and that's why all the boat people came. We had all the immigration. The people wanted to get away from communism. Those are the people we presumably were trying to help, but it wasn't. It shouldn't have been our fight. It shouldn't be our fight. You can't. Those are the forces of history and people and the Ho Chi Minh. It turned out, if you your history, he was a very intelligent man, very well educated. He went to the League of Nations to make it one nation, one country, and the French refused, and that League turned him out. So he eventually became the leader, and they threw the French out, and then they had the split. And the whole country would have been much better if it was unified under him. And in the first place, we had this idea of the domino theory, that if Ho Chi Minh ran the country and they became communist, that there would be a domino effect, which I think was wrong. Ho Chi Minh was...
Did you ever...
Yeah, go
Sorry.
ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, did you ever talk about this kind of the politics of the war while you were working at the hospital in Long Bend? Was it ever a conversation?
No, we really didn't. Our job was to take care of the kids. That's really what we thought about.
Oh, okay, that's good. So then the friends that you made while, were they fellow surgeons? Were they soldiers?
Yeah, all the guys officers? Surgeons that I was with during the time I was there.
Mm-hmm. And you kept in touch even after the war?
Yeah, to some extent, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So then...
Till today, I get emails back and forth from one of my friends. Who I was with. As a matter of fact, he went to Dartmouth also. The class
did
behind
you know
me.
Him when he went to Dartmouth? Did you know him when you went to Dartmouth together?
Oh, no, he was class of 55, and I didn't know.
But what was his name?
You know. We actually had four Dartmouth guys in my hospital at one point, four surgeons. We had a neurosurgeon, we had an orthopedic surgeon, and another general surgeon, myself, or four of us, had been at Dartmouth at one time or other. His brother was in my class, his older brother. He was an orthopedic surgeon. There was an old man, Floyd Robinson, who was younger. He was a neurosurgeon. And this guy, Baldwin, they were all Dartmouth guys.
Did you ever talk about Dartmouth?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we did.
That's...
fondly.
That's great to like have that chance to talk about home with people who can relate. Can we talk about the reunion? Was that 1994? What was the year?
94. It's the so-called 25th reunion.
Was it the only reunion?
It was our 25th. Well, I can't talk too much more about it than what I told you. It was a fairly big reunion, and don't forget, everybody was there 1 year, so you didn't necessarily know everybody who was there by any means. Now, there were like classes in college, you know, in your class, or whatever it is, of 2018 or something, meets, you're not going to be meeting with the class of 2016 or 20. So you don't know those people at all, really. And we had people there who went back to the hospital. Was formed in 1960, late 66 or 67, and existed till 72. So there were like different classes, groups that overlapped each other, but most of us only knew the people that were there for the 1 year you were there. So we sat in different groups, you know what I mean? I was with so-called the groups that were there from 68 to 69. We had our functions together with that group, but not with the whole, we had some common meetings, but most of us with our own so-called classmates, if you will, doctors and some nurses and patients as well. And it was nice. It was well organized. It was a very moving time, actually.
That's.
They had another reunion last year in September in Branson, Missouri. Apparently, it was fairly well attended. I didn't go to that. I just didn't feel like going, to tell you the truth. I didn't have enough of that.
Oh, no, understandable. Do you think? Or let me rephrase that. Did Vietnam end up being a very impactful time in your life, or do you look back on it more as, you know, this very short time?
Let's put it this way. It was a very important experience for me, life experience. It made me a better surgeon. It established some very important friendships, and it helped me get into, because of some of the work that I put out there, it helped me with my academic life and my contacts and getting into some of the major surgical societies because of that experience. I wouldn't want to do it again, but I'm glad that I did it and had that experience. I think that's the best. But yeah, it's an important part of my life. I mean, I when I think of the things that I've done or accomplished and what was important and what's not important, it ranks very high, obviously.
Mm-hmm. I guess I just want to ask, your experience seems very, I mean, you were a doctor. You had the doctor's experience in Vietnam. Whenever you hear about it, talked about today, you really don't hear that perspective very much, in my experience. Do you ever feel removed from the narratives that kind of dominate the conversation around around Vietnam?
I'm not quite sure what you mean. Could you rephrase that in something?
Yes. Oh, I apologize. Do you ever feel like you had a very different Vietnam experience than maybe what the culture surrounding Vietnam is, what it's thought of? You know, you think of people being fired at, you know, the movies that have been made about it. Do you ever feel removed?
Oh, yeah. Again, I think I try to help. I think that my experience as a doctor and as a surgeon is entirely different than somebody who was in the field risking his life in fighting. Mm-hmm. So there's no comparison to what may have, the impact that it may have had on them and their lives and to what I experienced. And similarly, my role as a surgeon and the way I thought of it and value that experience is probably a lot different than some of the guys who were pediatricians or internists who got sent over there and wound up, you know, just being medical doctors, not participating in the real surgical action. Mm-hmm. And just had to spend a year there treating gonorrhea and maybe hepatitis and a few things like that, and sitting around on their hands for a year. So the experience of the surgeons is entirely different than some of the other, you know, medical specialties, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly different than the soldiers who were fighting. So everybody, you know, it was impacted, I think, in an individual way. It's hard to say how somebody else might have reacted to it. But that's my feeling anyway.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you would like, that we haven't touched on, that you'd like to talk about, either in relation to Dartmouth or Vietnam?
Let me try to think a little bit about it. I think, again, I think it's, I really think we've pretty much covered the territory. It's something, again, that I give lectures now to the students. You know, I teach and spend 3 days a week at the hospital, you know, even though I'm retired, working with them a little bit. And I give them one lecture. Each group that comes in for 12 weeks, I give them one talk about Vietnam. Similar to the stories I've told you to some degree. It's more or less a travelogue. I've got a lot of slides and pictures, you know, and stuff in it. Mm-hmm. And so I keep giving that lecture once every 12 weeks. It keeps reminding me of these experiences and keeping it pretty vivid, you know, in my mind. So it remains somewhat important to me as an individual. And as I say, my children all turned out okay. And none of them seem to be psychologically impacted in an adverse way. They all have families of their own and kids of their own now. They have 9 grandchildren, and well, the kids are married and have homes of their own. And so I think my wife deserves a lot of credit because she was home with them and kept things on an even keel for them. She passed away 5 years ago.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And I've since she died of lymphoma, and I, fortunate enough, I met a lovely woman who's I knew from the community, whose husband also died about 7 years ago, 8 years ago, and we have since gotten married, and so life goes on. And mm-hmm. my son and his 2 boys for dinner. One of the boys is going off to his second year of college, so we're meeting for dinner so I can say goodbye to him, and you know, things are good for me.
Yeah. Well, that's a great phrase, life goes on, that certainly applies to so many things that we've talked about today.
I'm going to be up in Hanover, somewhere around, I think, the weekend of the Columbia game, the 23rd. It's my wife's birthday, and I'm taking her to Twin Farms, which is up near your way, And then we're going to come over to Hanover for the weekend. I have a mini reunion of the class of 54. So I may want to try to look up Professor Wright if I can. I've had a couple of nice chats with him. When I return to Vietnam, I think that's the last thing maybe. We were talking about coming back to Vietnam. When I went back, I had refrained from going back. And finally this year, there was a cruise, and a friend of ours wanted to take it. And it included Vietnam, a Southeast Asia cruise. So we went back, and I wanted to go up and see the base. The tours off the boat didn't include that. So I arranged for a private limousine with a driver and a guide with another couple. And to go up to Long Bin, and when we talked to the guy, who's a nice fellow, about 45, he answered why I wanted to go back, and I explained that's where my base is. We're going to waste our time going up there. There's nothing there. Your whole base has been taken down completely. The rubber plantation has grown back. The town has grown bigger. There's a supermarket on a corner of the base where your hospital must have been. And there's really nothing of interest to see. But we have other things to see. So he did take us around. We had a wonderful day with the guide. But I never did go back to put my feet on the base where I was. Mm-hmm. We saw a lot of other stuff. And, of course, I was in Saigon where I had been before. And the funny thing is, when I was there this time, I was now, what was it? It was over 40 years, 45 years ago that I was there as a young man. And it felt like it happened to somebody else. I felt like a tourist rather than a returning, veteran or soldier. So emotionally, it was, for me at least, it was disappointing almost that it didn't have more of an impact on me. I was pretty disgusted because it was this country that's on the brink of breaking out and becoming an economic factor, and we're dealing with them, and all kinds of American businesses opening up and people making money and all that stuff, and all we did was lose 65,000 lives. So it was not a great experience. There were about a dozen guys on the ship going back for the first time. We had a little meeting on the boat, had some drinks together and shared some stories. So it's always nice to reminisce and hear the stories, but when the reality came of going back and walking around with it, and you're just another tourist to them, it didn't mean very much, to tell you the truth. That part of it was disappointing.
Yeah. I mean, who knows if there would have been
if I were a fighting man and I went to the spot where my friend was shot and stood on the ground, I maybe would have reacted entirely differently. You see, it's a different thing, but for me, this is the way I felt.
No, and that's completely valid, and I'm so thankful that you were able to share this with us. I'm going to stop recording in just a second, but thank you again so much, Dr. Brief.
Okay, if you have any more questions or something, feel free to call or email.